The other one is about people complaining about young people being on social media all the time. When I was a young person, I watched television all the time. Spent the entire afternoon watching television. But what we need is we need their skills in the workplace, because that's the future.
Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk. I am a career coach for tech managers and CEO of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Russell Dalgleish. He is a board advisor, investor, keynote speaker on leadership, and also co-founder of the Scottish Business Network. Welcome, Russell.
Thank you.
So great to have you here, and let's get going straight away so that folks can understand what it is that you do and what your mission is. So tell us, what is the Scottish Business Network and what are you doing with that?
The Scottish Business Network is an organization that was created to help Scottish companies advance their ambitions to export. So what we've done is we've mapped the Scottish diaspora or diaspora around the world. These are Scots who have either been born Scottish and then left the country, or studied in Scotland or worked in Scotland. Individuals with a real love for the country. And what we've done is we've mapped about 8,500 in a community across the globe. Mm-hmm. And we then connect them with Scottish companies that are looking to export. It's what we call a not-for-profit or a B Corp, and we just have a tremendous amount of fun doing it. So I have the strangest job, which is I travel. This is one of many things I do, but I get to travel the globe, and most of the time I meet people with the same accent as me, which is particularly strange.
Oh, that's great. So you're traveling around the world. You're not in Scotland, but yet you get to connect with people who are from Scotland, born in Scotland, but yeah, for whatever reason left.
Yeah.
Okay. So can you give us an example, you know, a business that you've helped or a person that you've helped, so you can kind of really connect to what it is that you do and what your mission is?
Well, I suppose there's a couple of quite good examples. So we had a Scottish-based digital company that was looking to expand into the Middle East, and we were able to introduce the gentleman to half a dozen Scottish senior contacts who worked in Abu Dhabi, Dubai, and Jeddah. They were able to give him an insight into how to work in the country. We then set him up with DMCC, which is one of our partners, which is the largest free trade zone in the region. So it's a free trade zone consisting of 14,500 companies.
Okay.
They were able to help him get set up there in country. And everyone's got together to help him close his first couple of deals. So he's particularly happy.
Awesome.
A second and a much more interesting example for me was that I was approached by a young American tech entrepreneur. He'd studied at Dundee University in Scotland. He'd then returned to the States to live in the Midwest and had recently moved to San Jose. So he contacted me to understand if I may know any investors or people that could help him from amongst the Scottish community in America.
Yeah.
And we were actually able to introduce him to three Scots living in San Jose. So they were able to introduce him into the ecosystem and help him get up and running and then introduce him to the right people.
Oh, that's so wonderful. So he was born in the US, but yep. Went to school in Scotland.
Yep, that's right. Well, I think what he did was he reached out to me because he recognized the fact that he had an awareness of our organization and thought we may be able to help.
Yep.
What he never expected was that we would introduce him to senior people within the new city he'd just moved to.
Understood.
And the reason I like that story is that it's why a diaspora organization isn't a networking group. We're more of a family. So you could imagine if that was your own son or daughter moving to a new town, someone else from the family looking out for them was what was essential.
Mm-hmm.
So it's led us to, we have a great deal of trust between the people within the network. So, and all there to support each other.
I absolutely love that. And it probably, there's probably some unmet expectations, but in a good way. And what I mean by that is when you see something like, oh, it's a business network. Okay, we're going to do some networking and we're going to talk about business. But even just from those two stories, I hear the family aspect of it. It was like, wow, I thought I was going to get, this is what I mean by the unmet expectations. Like, I thought I was going to get like some business network connections and introductions, but what I got was kind of a membership into this whole new family of people who were supporting me. So that's just so
absolutely
wonderful.
And if I could give you a couple of examples of that. So we hold monthly events in cities around the world. The most recent one was in London, and we bring three Scottish companies to London to present to our diaspora network there of Scots. And rather than them presenting to an audience they're not familiar with, we instead interview them. So beforehand, they're provided with a questionnaire, and then we do a telephone interview, and then comes the big day itself. So our next event is with Silicon Valley Bank in London on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So the companies that present there, they get 10 minutes to have a chat with me in front of an audience. And the very first question I ask them is where they were born. Because if they happen to be born in a small Scottish town like Selkirk, and there's someone in the audience who was born there as well, that person will help the visiting Scot. It doesn't matter what their company is or anything, they will help them because they'll know they're one of their own. So that's a really key example for us. The second one is your link between people and technology. So we couldn't have built this network for the very little money I've spent if it wasn't for where technology was at today. Mm-hmm. So we've used products and techniques that are only available in the digital world, which have allowed us to find these senior Scots around the world, reach out to them and connect with them. And that wouldn't have been possible even 5 years ago.
And so when you say technology, what do you, can you give us examples there?
We're using a range of technologies, like a technology stack, if you would. Mm-hmm. We have a key piece of technology, which was actually developed in Scotland by an organization called VeriConnect. The two chaps who completed PhDs there developed a piece of software for alumni networks. And we use that for bringing together Scots around the world. We identify them through using alumni networks are good, business associations, things like LinkedIn, and Facebook to a lesser extent. And this allows us to identify the individual as being potentially Scottish. So someone around the world, we can say they're probably Scottish. Mm-hmm. Then we have a rather sophisticated way to communicate with them and messaging to get their attention without sounding like we're trying to sell something. Mm-hmm. That's been really important. Now, that's where we are at the moment with technology. What we're going to move on to is just extraordinary. So we have two technology platforms we're adopting, one out of France and one out of Canada. And what they will allow us to do is to identify someone's ethnicity based on their family name. So it provides us with a percentage likelihood of the nationality of the individual based on their family name.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And now I am understanding when we first met, so for this part wasn't recorded, but when Russell and I first met, he mentioned my family name.
Yes, that's right.
So now I understand your fascination and your interest with people's last names.
Yeah.
That's very cool. And you know, this is so powerful. And the piece that resonated the most with me was, you know, it's not just finding people, right? You know, so anybody who runs a business like myself or anyone in a leadership position can connect with the idea of, okay, how can I connect with other people? How can I find my tribe? Who's like me so that I can reach out to them and connect with them and learn more? So certainly finding people, that can be a challenge. But then I was actually just talking to a client yesterday about, he's like, yeah, I know people, but it's kind of creepy to just, or I know people who know people, they may be second or third degree connections. Yeah. But he said, you know, it's kind of creepy to just kind of reach out to them because, you know, I don't know, I just feel uncomfortable with that. So to have a way and to develop a way to do that without making it sound too salesy or creepy or, you know, over the top, and just say, hey, look, I think it would be beneficial to connect. So it sounds like as part of the software that was created, that's part of the messaging, is it's to make sure, look, this is just, we just want to connect here. All humans want to connect, and that's the message that we're sending. So awesome.
You're quite correct. All humans want to connect. But we have a natural resistance to connecting with people we don't know. So we have a natural resistance to someone we don't know phoning us up. We naturally go that cold call. I don't enjoy this conversation.
Yeah.
But we're on a mission. We have a very clear vision that what we want to do is we want to, for no economic benefit to us, we want to create the largest network on the planet of people with a common interest in the country, Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who celebrate when the Scottish soccer team scores a goal. These are people who enjoy Scottish music or have a family link from somewhere that they don't quite understand, but there's something about this is who they really are. So yeah. We want to take advantage of that, and in a business context, use it whereby if you're a Scot who's built a successful business in Texas in the oil and gas industry,
mm-hmm.
if I was to write to you and say, would you give 5 minutes of your time to speak to a young Scottish entrepreneur who has developed something in the oil and gas industry, yeah. you're likely to say yes.
Right.
Absolutely. We all like to help.
Exactly. And that's what helps us get over that natural resistance of yep. people we don't know, because hey, we have something in common here,
yes.
and it's a really strong bond and a strong link. And you actually just answered a question that I was gonna ask, and it seemed like a silly question. The question was gonna be, do you have to be Scottish in order to join the Scottish Business Network? But in your answer there, it was some connection to Scotland, whether it's the music yeah. or the sports or some, maybe it's a distant family connection, some connection, and that's what you're looking for. So it's not a requirement to have been born and raised in Scotland in order to be part of the network.
No, what we say is, for first generation, it would be born in Scotland, studied in Scotland or worked in Scotland, but where it's it might be a historical thing that you're second or third generation, but you still view that as being you have some kind of link with that country.
Mm-hmm.
So part of our mapping, so we're doing an exercise at the moment with the University of Edinburgh, and we're mapping Scottish associated organizations around the world.
Yeah.
So there are 98 saltire associations around the world, which are groups of individuals who get together to celebrate Scottish culture. So this could be marching bands, or it could be poetry, or it could be music. But a lot of those individuals will have an interest in business as well. So we're reaching out and connecting with them all.
Awesome, I love that. So I'm going to turn the conversation, Russell, in a slightly different direction, although I think some of the themes that we've been talking about in this first part of the conversation are going to keep playing out, networking and connection and really just connecting with other folks who can add value. So you do a number of things, as you alluded to. And one of the other things that you do is you do keynote speeches. You've done a number of mm-hmm. keynote speeches. And so what I'm curious about is, and I know this is sort of like picking your favorite child or picking your favorite friend, but if you have a favorite keynote speech, and you know what ideas that you present during that speech that really shift people's thinking about leadership or something related to that?
I'll give you my favorite one is when I talk about leadership, because I feel, particularly in our world today, we have a huge craving for leadership, particularly non-ego-led leadership. So I'm just back from Brazil, but I was talking about leadership with a soul there. So I was working from Michael Anderson's book, Soul-Centered Leadership.
Yeah.
And I was talking there about the fact that we can build companies, but not with a reflection of the ego of the leader. Because we all know today we can see the people who are ego-led leaders, but we can do it much more from the soul, much more to the benefit of all. You know, anyone who's building a company for the benefit of their shareholders is going to really struggle. You know, there has to be much more clarity around the vision as to how that's going to appeal to us all. You know, the generation coming up are the hardest working generation I believe we've ever seen. But they don't want to work for companies unless they agree with the vision of that company. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a little anecdote from that speech, which is about, I think it's about the opportunity in the world today, particularly for the smaller business. So I was working with an 18-year-old young man called Bruce Walker in Edinburgh. And Bruce had just put on a conference with my help in our capital city of Edinburgh, where he was studying. And it had all gone very well, and we brought together lots of interesting speakers. And he said he wanted to do another conference. And I suggested to him, if we're going to do another one, why don't we try and make it slightly harder, slightly more fun? So rather than doing it in Edinburgh, why don't we do it on the subject of technology and do it in San Francisco? Mm-hmm. So Bruce was a little bit anxious about this since he'd never been to America before. But I worked in San Jose and I said, that'll work. So he took my confidence and we raised some money and we agreed to go and do this conference in San Francisco. But he wanted Apple involved because he felt that was a really good brand. So in my generation, to get someone from Apple involved, that would involve probably looking through my connections in Scotland to meet someone in London, to maybe get from London to someone in the States. Mm-hmm. But Bruce solved the problem. Bruce sent an email to Tim Cook. And he told me this, and I went, that's a good idea, Bruce. That was a nice thing to do. And but I was quite surprised when 3 weeks later we got a response. So we got a response from Tim Cook. Now, I'm sure it wasn't from the gentleman himself as chief exec of Apple, but it was written as though it was. And the email said, "Dear Bruce, I'm afraid I can't join you when you come to San Francisco, but I wish you every success in your conference." So that was cut and paste that and put it on the website. The second paragraph changed my life, though, because it showed to me how the world had changed. The second paragraph said, "Bruce, though I can't meet you, we have another British gentleman here called Jonathan Ives. I've passed your contact details on to him." So that's a gentleman that we know in the UK as Sir Johnny Ives, who I believe has designed a fair number of the Apple products in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And off the back of that introduction, we didn't get to speak to Johnny Ives, but we got to speak to several people within Apple. And on the basis that we were introduced by Tim Cook, we got really good progress and Apple were very supportive of our plans. And that taught me about learning from young people. An 18-year-old man was able to do something I at 50 hadn't thought about doing. Something about the way big corporations respond today to small companies. Something about asking people for help. And you could just do all that today. So I spend a lot of time now advising people, if you want to speak to someone at a big company, go and contact the chief exec.
Yes. Right. That is so powerful for all of the reasons that you mentioned, Russell, and for so many others too. And that is the perfect example of shifting in thinking, your own thinking. And it probably shifted the 18-year-old's thinking as well, and so many other people who just listened to that story, who might have had the belief that, oh, there's no way that Tim Cook or someone similar is going to get back to him. There's no way that this is going to come out to anything. Oh my God, he even sent the email to begin with. You know, how, like, whatever beliefs might be getting in the way, that just crushes them. You know what I mean?
So just to talk about that for a second. So how do you send the email? Because who do you send it to? Right. Well, back then there was a website called CEO Email. And CEO Email listed the email addresses of all the chief execs.
Yeah.
Well, that solved the problem on how to send the email. Sure. There was also the structure of the email, you know, making sure that it was very, you know, it was very complimentary about the individual you're writing to. Mm-hmm. And it was also very, I suppose, charming would be a word, you know, because it was part of the culture of being Scottish. So it just worked so well. And I've used that, you know, to get the most incredible meetings simply by asking people for help. And I've also spoken to entrepreneurs across the world who've built multi-million pound organizations And they often tell me that at one point they reached out to the most senior person in their space and asked for 5 minutes on the phone, and they got the call, and then it led on to other things.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, stranger things have happened, right? You know, that's
it's. Don't know unless you try.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like the worst thing that could have happened in that case is you didn't get a response, or you got a response that was merely just that first paragraph, I'm sorry, can't help. And it really was that second paragraph that it was whoever it was that did respond to the email, that it wasn't just copy paste, move on. It was, we're going to help you, right? We're going to help you take action here and move forward. And that shows a true commitment to wanting to help other people by
also
extending that out.
It also reflects and empowers a brand. Mm-hmm. So we're not that surprised that we got that response from Apple, because we would have an understanding of what their brand stands for. So actually showing the fact that the vision and the mission for that particular company was completely aligned with the way people responded to emails.
Yeah.
That's what we've all got to learn. You know, I do that leadership presentation and I ask people about what is the vision for their company. And many people tell me, oh, my company's got a vision, but I can't quite remember what it is.
Yeah.
There's a fantastic, I refer to it in my talk, a fantastic speech by the ex-chief executive GE. Mm-hmm. I forgot what his name is. And he talks about the fact that if you are the leader of the company, your job is to remind everybody for what the company vision is,
right?
How we're going to deliver it, and what's in it for them.
Yeah.
Chief exec's job is to remind everybody about that on a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Almost to the point where you might feel like a broken record, but some people might have to tell people 10 times, 20 times until they really connect with that mission. But then it's and what do we do? You know, how can I do this, and how can we together take these actions to move there? And yeah, the what's in it for me part, because we all deserve to get rewarded, especially if we're really putting in a lot of effort in aligning with that mission. So yeah.
This is such an important thing. So if you were to look at the website for the organization I chair, Scottish Business Network, and you go to the landing page, the first thing you see is the company name, and the second line is our mission. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think companies make a mistake where they take their vision and their mission and their values and they kind of hide it somewhere. It should be front and center. That's the reason why we get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah, right. You live, you sleep, you eat, you breathe, you sweat, you tear. Like, that's the mission.
Yeah.
I've seen so many quote-unquote leadership talks where they talk about MVV, mission, vision, values, you know, yeah. And they almost say it as if it's like an afterthought. And oh, and make sure that you're in line with an MVV or the mission, vision, values. But almost it's almost ironic in saying it that way, because it's not an afterthought. It's if you don't know what it is and you can't speak it every single day to anyone, whether it's somebody at your company or whether it's somebody who wants to know about what it is that you do but isn't in that field, to be able to say that, like, that's the test of having a mission that you're truly connected with and aligning with. So it sounds like that's a big piece of what you mean by non-ego-driven but more soul-driven leadership. Yep. It's based on that mission and getting people behind that and taking actions to support that.
Absolutely, because it's the vision we all understand, the mission, the way we're going to achieve the vision, and then the values. These are the rules under which we will guide every decision we make. Mm-hmm. So actually, that's your company in a nutshell, because it's really easy, because then you're going to know what decisions, you know where you're going, you know how you're going to get there, and you know how you're going to judge every decision that you take. So suddenly the whole thing works. Where I have a particular hang up is that we look at vision, mission, and values, and we say that's the rules the company will operate by, which is great. But then we say, but if you're in the boardroom, we have to take different decisions, because we have to step out from those rules to satisfy shareholders, or sometimes to satisfy personal glory. Mm-hmm. But it's not. Those rules apply the same to every single person involved in the organization. And when we saw things like the banking crisis, and we looked at the people at the top of those companies, were they living by the vision of the company, the mission the company was on? But I don't think so.
No.
So I think, again, it comes back to why I was so impressed by Apple's response back then.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely could not agree more.
Hi, everyone. We'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50 plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. You can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh, and you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to jenbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's jenbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview.
And speaking more of mission, one of your other missions, if folks take a look at your LinkedIn profile, you talk about, quote, addressing the gender imbalance in commerce. So let's switch gears just a little bit and talk about that and what actions that you've taken there. And if you're willing to share, what kind of results that you've gotten in terms of addressing the gender imbalance in commerce.
Well, that sounds like a very worthy goal, but possibly one that's difficult for me to do. But I think we can all take steps in our own lives.
Sure.
So I work with the Association of Scottish Business Women in Scotland, and I also work with Changing the Chemistry. So Association of Scottish Business Women encourages and supports female-led small businesses. Changing the Chemistry looks at encouraging more diversity at board level. So I speak at events, I help to judge competitions, etc. So I do positivity there on diversity by I give up my time to go and support those organizations. Mm-hmm. When it comes to in my own dealings, I hear this a lot. People talk about the fact that, well, we have to try and make sure we've got the same number of more women or more men involved in our conference. And typically it's difficult getting female speakers. That's mm-hmm. something I hear quite a lot. So we don't think that way. We try to think like our younger generation, who don't see men and women, they just see people. So our last Scottish Business Network event in January 2019, we had one keynote speaker and we had 3 companies presenting. All were female.
Yeah.
Now, that is not because it was a deliberate thing, it just happened. Mm-hmm. We did an event at lunchtime, it was 2 men speaking. But I believe that it's not difficult to get female representation in all the things we do. We just have to work a little bit harder to make that happen. We deliver them under Scottish Business Network. We deliver Scottish International Week each year, which is in the fall of each year. We run a whole series of events for a period of 1 week. And the most successful of all the events we ran was a panel on female leadership. Mm-hmm. So we had 4 women on the panel. And the panel was chaired by my colleague, Kendra Byers, who's, I think she's 24. Mm-hmm. And the discussion took an hour, and then the discussion ran on for another hour. Mm-hmm. Because it's such an area that we have to talk about more openly. And it's not just diversity by gender, it's diversity by every other measure as well. But we just have to all work harder to make that happen.
Yeah. And I know this is a hard question, but what does work harder mean? What does that look like?
What work harder means that if I'm putting on a conference, it's If I advertise for speakers, I will get 70% to 80% men to women.
Yep.
So that means I've got to work harder to encourage more women to speak at the event. So I will give up. I will say, right, that man can speak, that man can speak, that man can speak. And then when it comes to the female speakers, I might phone them all up and ask them if they'll speak. So I will dedicate more time to doing that. I will try to make sure that we have someone who comes from a different group in our society, for example. So we will have someone perhaps who's comes from with a disability or a handicap and ask them to speak. Mm-hmm. We will look at people from different ethnic groups actually get involved as well. Sure. Now, it's harder for us because those are smaller groups in our society and less like a big bunch of ego-driven men who are all dying to speak. But we just do it. And that's what we've got to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's about spending time, spending energy, deliberately, intentionally reaching out to groups, to people who, you know, for example, that you might want to have on this panel, that you might want to hire, for example, if we were to apply it over to, you know, making the workforce more diverse in terms of gender and ethnicity and all of that. If you send out a job ad, 70 to 80%, especially if it's in tech, right, 70 to 80% is gonna land in front of male eyes, and females are gonna ignore it unless you spend the extra time, like you're talking about, encouraging people to apply. Like, this is for you. This is the perfect, you know, speaking position for you, job position for you, and we want you here. Opening them with welcome arms. It makes such a difference.
And recognizing when we don't have a balance, that we do have a problem, and reacting to that. And by diversity, I think we need to look at diversity of age as well.
Yeah.
I think across the Western world, we're seeing examples where the business community is raising concerns with the education sector to say, the people that you are producing out of the education sector aren't fitting well into my company. Education system, you must change. Whereas to me, I say to the business leaders, you're going to have to show a bit more creativity and imagination, because those people coming out of our universities today are the best they ever have been. They're the best educated, and by the way, they're the best bloody hard working you've ever seen before. They've put themselves through university, they've worked part-time in a job, and they've got all the digital skills you need. You should be crawling over each other to hire these people.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I cannot agree more. That's a trend in the US as well. People talking about millennials, and they're so lazy and they're so entitled. And it's
Can I tell you something, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
So let's compare a millennial today with a millennial someone in the 80s who went to university.
Sure.
So I went to university in 1982. I received a full grant from the British government to cover all my costs for going to university. I also got rent relief. So I got a reduction on my rent because I was a student. Mm-hmm. I also qualified for unemployment benefit during the vacation period. So the state paid me during vacations. Right? I basically took the money I got, and I had a really good time with that money. I never worked part-time the whole time I was at university. And I came out into the workforce, and I was fairly not employable. But the company I went to, the bank, actually worked with me because they recognized I had the skills, and they realized that they had to go through a mentoring process with me to make me useful.
Yeah.
Whereas I look at the just how hardworking our young people are today is incredible. The other one is about people complaining about young people being on social media all the time.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a young person, I watched television all the time. When I was a student, I spent the entire afternoon watching television. But what we need is we need their skills in the workplace, because that's the future.
That's right. That's right. And I hear it so often, and sometimes from clients of ours who are technical managers, and just also friends and colleagues who might be leading, let's just say, a team of software engineers, and they may have just brought on a couple new software engineers, either fresh out of college or fresh out of a coding academy, maybe they're 18, 19, 21, early 20s, and talk about how they're so quote unquote hard to work with and I can't connect with them. And, you know, how is it that I lead these people that they're almost like it's like aliens or something like that. Mm-hmm. And very often the conversation just becomes they are people too. They are humans too. Yes, maybe with slightly different or very different experiences than you've had, because maybe you grew up in a different time in a different place and had different access to different resources. But how about we remember that they're here and they're the future, which is kind of what you're alluding to, which is what's so inspiring. They're the future. So we owe it to them to do everything we can to support them and help them grow. Otherwise, the future is looking pretty bleak.
I just think that because of what's happened with digitization, that younger people today have a natural advantage in the fact that they come from a digital age. So we're building these companies and we all know we're going to have to communicate digitally. So don't we want people who communicate digitally naturally to tell us what we should be doing? So the young people have it, and I'd get them in your company now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Such a great conversation. I'm glad you brought that up, Russell, because it is a topic that's very close to my heart, you know, talking about supporting everyone, you know, everyone from, you know, 2 years old or however young, you know, and through the education system to people in their 60s and 70s and 80s who are still wanting to make an impact, and everyone in between. So that's such an important topic. Yeah, so we have a few minutes left. So at this point, I'm going to shift gears to the last question. And this is a question that I ask to all of my podcast guests. And that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job, in your career?
The biggest people-related challenge is communication. So we think we've explained ourselves. We think we have alignment of purpose and what the project's going to consist of. We have the verbal conversation, and then everyone goes off and does something different from what we expected. And I think that's, you cannot over-communicate. I don't mean micromanage. I mean find different ways to communicate what we've all agreed to do. It's a fantastic example between the US and the UK, because I've spent years working in the US, and even though we're both speaking English, we're meaning completely different things. and I always remember that when I'm dealing with, when I'm, you know, I run an advisory practice, Exalta, in the UK, and I really work hard with the clients I work with to understand how we're communicating. And have we both got the same understanding of what we think we're going to go and do? And the essential need to write it down so that there's no dubiety at all. And also to be open so that if the person wants to come back and go, can I just double check this is what we're wanting to do? And to be really open to have that discussion. So I think the biggest challenge is communication.
Yeah, and it's often the communication gaps that lead to mistakes. And look, there's nothing necessarily wrong with a mistake as long as we learn from it, but that lead to those mistakes and those failures, and that could have been prevented, or that at least could have prevented, you know, disagreements or arguments or things like that, when people assume that they're on the same page and they assume that they're connecting, but not really, especially when you're talking about complex things like, you know, building an algorithm to reach out to people or building a software program. Like, this is complex stuff. Like, repeat it and repeat yourself and double check. I'm a chronic double checker. But you know what? I would rather ask and double check and is this what you mean? Than, you know, have a preventable mistake happen, or, you know, cause it to ruin relationships, or, you know, ruin a piece of software or whatever it is. That's a really good words to live by, that you cannot over communicate.
Yeah, it's all about that area of expectation setting as well. And I said, you know, we said we'd write a press release, but I'd assumed you'd spell check it. not I would spell check it, or you would send it to this person or send it to that person, or this is the message, or this is the nuance I wanted to go into it. And even like, what do we mean by a press release? You really get an insight into how difficult communication is once you start working internationally. Because for this call, I've got a call with you at 4 p.m., but that's 4 p.m. in the UK, but it's probably 11 a.m. for you on the Eastern Seaboard.
Yep.
And then when we have a conference call, I believe in signing in a minute before it starts, so that when it starts on the hour, I'm ready.
Yes.
Whereas for some people, they mean, well, on the hour means they'll dial in on the hour. And it's really interesting how you try to get through these. You have to really actually get down to that detail. So when we're going to have a conference call, what it means is that everyone's going to dial in 2 minutes before, so we're all ready to start. And to explain to people why it matters, not just because I'm being anal and old-fashioned, but really because it's everyone's time.
That's right.
So it's that kind of communication and really making it clear to everyone.
Yeah, and not taking things for granted, not assuming that everyone's going to be like that. That, oh, if it starts at 11 a.m. Eastern, that means I'm going to get set up at, you know, at two minutes before or 5 minutes before. If I have to get my laptop all set up and plug in my headphones and or whatever it is, that I'm doing that beforehand. And if that's the way that you want to do it, you communicate it. Versus other people are a little bit more, you know, that it's 11 is when I dial in, so we'll start at 11:05. And if that's how you want to work, that's fine, you know, but just make sure that that's what people are expecting, so that you can then make the most use of the time. I'm curious, because you brought up, you know, international differences, Russell. So that was a good example, you know, in terms of making sure we're specific about time zones, making sure we're specific about when the meeting actually starts. Can you think of other international communication gaps that seem to come up that we can all learn from, so that we could stop making those mistakes?
I think it's not to be scared. So I you mentioned some of the talks I've done. So I've delivered keynotes about leadership and, you know, this disruptive world we're living in. So in the last 6 months, I've delivered in Dubai in Arabic, and in São Paulo in Portuguese. Now, I've done that because I've had a highly skilled interpreter with me. And I think I would encourage everyone to try to do more internationally and lose that fear of language. Like, I'm not skilled in learning languages, or I'm just too lazy, but I believe, and the feedback I get is, I'm wonderful working with interpreters, because I know how important they are, and they are the person who's communicating the message. And I think it's about taking that risk, because the opportunities in the world today are just incredible. And people want to buy products from you. Mm-hmm. And the reason they're not buying your product or service at the moment is they don't know who you are.
Yeah.
So you have to get out there, use the technologies to tell everyone. And, you know, I just posted a WhatsApp message back to the people I know in Brazil. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I went onto Google, I typed it in English, and Google gave me a rough translation in Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's probably not right, but it's fully close enough that they will get an understanding of what I'm trying to say. But the people in Brazil really appreciated the fact I tried. And that's what everyone around the world does. They appreciate it when we try.
Yeah, absolutely. And that resonates with me on several levels, including the building a business journey that I'm on right now. And I've always said, you know, so right now, all of our clients are US based, English speaking US.
Yep.
And I've always said, you know, the next level for us is to at least expand it to other English speaking countries around the world, Australia, yep, the UK. And while I say that, there is that tinge of fear. Like, I'm going to admit that there's that tinge of fear of, I've never been to Australia. I've never actually even been to the UK. I've been to other European countries, which is a little strange, but you know, and there is that tinge of fear though, but having you say that, it's like, oh, well, you can just get an interpreter. You know what I mean? Like, when this is your mission, you know, to kind of tie it back to what we were talking about earlier, when this is your mission, you do what it takes. It's actually like our obligation to connect with other people, not just in our city or in our state or in our country, but all around the world.
And it's such a wonderful thing to do, because the more you travel, the more people you meet around the world, you realize we're all the same. And you also realize just how lucky we are in the UK and the US. I did a training course last year in Abu Dhabi with people, leaders from Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Egypt, as well as Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And what struck me was, you know, I was coming from a country that's got some hiccups going through Brexit. America's got some challenges as well. But I don't have the kind of challenge that someone has from Syria, because my assumption was that their challenge of doing business in Syria would be bombs going off. And it's not. It's widespread corruption. Can you imagine, we take for granted in the US and the UK that if we do a piece of work and we send in an invoice, someone will pay it. Mm-hmm. That's not true all across the world.
Yeah.
What an advantage we have.
Yeah.
But I would encourage anyone you're listening who wants to come and do business in Scotland, we're open and more than delighted to have those conversations.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for that, for reaching out. Russell, and for offering that. And if people wanted to learn more about what you do or wanted to reach out in other ways, what would be the best way to connect with you?
I suppose Twitter, which is Russell Exalta, RussellExolta, or through LinkedIn, or to any of these other myriad of ways of talking to me.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise, your stories, and for spending time with us today, Russell. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thank you so much. Yeah.